Superstition runs deep in certain publishing companies. For instance, the word Caldecott is taboo. If that word is mentioned with reference to a particular book, it might jinx it. I'm so thankful to the people at Harcourt Brace for not uttering that word over Smoky Night, because early one morning this past February, something quite extraordinary happened in my life. I was honored as the recipient of the 1995 Caldecott Medal. Daily, I'm overwhelmed with joy and gratitude for this prestigious award. My son Jericho, who is 12, said, "I've always heard of other families being famous, but I never thought it would happen to us." But my 5-year-old son Ariel wonders, "How come I didn't get a Caldecott? I draw better than Dad." I recall 1966, sitting in my first grade class and receiving a mimeographed worksheet. The class had just come in from squinting into the clear blue Florida sky, trying to pick out a wisp of vapor trail from one of the space launches at Cape Canaveral. On the mimeographed paper, there were 12 squares, and within each square, a drawing. Underneath each drawing was a word that could be completed with a vowel. Near the center of the page were the letters N, blank, S-E, and above them, the profile of a nose. I filled in the blank with the vowel O, and afterward, drew lines to the nose and made a profile of a face. That was when I first realized I wanted to be a drawer. I had no idea what an illustrator, designer, or art director was. What I knew was that I had found my gift, drawing pictures. There were a few things in high school that propelled me toward a career in illustration. One was meeting Cecilia, my wife. After a year of sarcastic banter, we became close friends. The focus of my time in art class became seeing how much I could distract her from her weavings and batiks. But she taught me about color and how to see color, about the colors you can miss if you're not paying attention, like the color of black licorice when you bite into it, a kind of greenish, brownish, yellow-black. At the time, my work was dominated by grays and muted tones. Cecilia opened my eyes to vivid color, and I began to use it. The second key thing was having a great art instructor, Sandra Toby. She had a gift for motivating students, and she encouraged us to enter numerous competitions. She showed us that there were jobs out there doing artwork, money for pictures. Through her, I was introduced to Dwayne Hansen, the hyperrealist sculptor. I apprenticed with him for several years through high school and art school. While working for Dwayne, I was exposed to a lot of the superrealist movement through his personal collection. I was drawn to the movement, and my work, very tight, realistic pieces, reflected it. I labored intensely, 60 to 80 hours over a drawing 6 inches square. I drew tiny circles with a razor-sharp pencil to create a rich, gradual tonal quality, almost like in a photograph. Until while working on an assignment at 3 a.m., I thought, why not just take a photograph? Think of all the time it would save. Determined to find another approach to drawing, I began to experiment with a variety of techniques. A turning point finally came when I saw the German Expressionist show at the Guggenheim in 1980. I saw beautiful work that conveyed the emotion of the artist with immediate, direct line, bold, simple, loose brush strokes. Another influence on my development as an artist was the work of William Steig. I found a copy of his book Male and Female in a used bookstore. I was immediately drawn in by the depth of characterization he conveyed in so few lines. I sought out other Steig books. As I became more acquainted with his drawings, I saw an evolution in his work that I recognized as he moved from tightly rendered pieces toward a looser line. In 1979, when I arrived in San Diego, I began to show my portfolio and to receive editorial assignments. Although the pay was low, these assignments allowed a lot of room for experimentation. I had the freedom to work in a variety of mediums: oils, acrylics, pen and ink, watercolor, woodcut, scratchboard, as many as I could find. Typically, at the end of an assignment, there would be some materials left over. I would take those and make a small piece as a thank you for the art director who had given me the job. I'd send it along with the completed work. The response to these pieces was very positive, and I realized I'd hit upon a very effective way of promoting my work. These personal pieces allowed me to find my own direction in drawing and to become comfortable with the way I drew naturally. And, of course, the ideas I worked out in these personal pieces found their way into the work I did for assignments. These gift pieces eventually evolved into limited edition books that Cecilia and I collaborated in producing at the end of each year. There is nothing like receiving a piece made by hand. Part of the ethic of the arts and crafts movement was the idea that as you were surrounded by pieces made by hand, your life would be enriched. Furniture, ceramics, textiles, and books all bore the mark of the craftsman's hand. These touch-of-the-hand pieces became a format for my personal work and sometimes resulted in assignments specifically requesting a new style. The distinction between work for assignments and personal work narrowed. In 1989, I began to experiment with a series of bold, loose, brushstroke faces. My goal was to create an image without hesitation, lifting the brush from the surface as few times as possible. I believed that once I hesitated with the brushstroke, I'd pause to question what I was doing rather than completing the piece in one stream of thought. I wanted to put down on paper exactly what I had imagined. I experimented with this style for about 3 years. In 1992, while visiting my brother in Brazil, I worked on a series of faces as we traveled down the Amazon River. That series was incorporated into our year-end book, Sweet Peas. We combined the faces with text and objects, found and made. For example, we bound in one spread a latex glove, in another a postcard from the 1930s. One page was a piece of waxed paper. During that year, Diane Dendrati at Harcourt Brace contacted me to illustrate Neighborhood Odes by Gary Soto. I stopped by Harcourt's office to give her a copy of Sweet Peas. When she saw it, she said, "I have a manuscript I haven't known who to assign to. Seeing what you've done here, I'd like you to take a look at it." Of course, that manuscript was Smoky Night. I saw the possibilities right away. Eve Bunting had taken a timely subject and had handled it in a truly sensitive and thoughtful way. I felt the book could have a positive effect and help erode barriers of prejudice and intolerance. And above all, it was a book that could be a part of the post-riot healing process. I wanted to do Smoky Night. I wanted the art to have the same dignity as the manuscript. Although I had done hundreds of faces and images in this style, I was challenged by the job of carrying out character continuity throughout the book. I wanted Smoky Night to achieve a balance between text, the design, the painted illustrations, and the collaged backgrounds. I wanted each element to add to the book to create a cohesive unit. One important decision I made was to use the same color palette for all the characters in the story. I did this to avoid any indication of ethnic background and to let their personalities speak for themselves. I would like to thank the members of the Caldecott Committee for selecting and awarding Smoky Night the Caldecott Medal. I want to thank Eve Bunting for her wonderful manuscript. At Harcourt Brace, I'd like to thank Ruben Pfeffer, who, when he had reviewed the F&Gs for Smoky Night, called me to say, "Smoky Night is a book that raises the level of what a children's picture book can be." Louise Houghton for the freedom to design and create Smoky Night. Diane Dendrati, my editor, who had the vision and insight into my work to give me Smoky Night to illustrate. William Steig for pointing the way. And most of all, my sweet wife Cecilia, who always believed and knew what could be.